everybody.
Log Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Hello, I'm Kay Thompson, and welcome to Kay Thompson Live. I'm laughing because of the fact that there's so many things happening, you know, in the world today, and so many things happening around us, and so many different things that we want to talk about. So it's really going to be an exciting program. Geez, what did we do today? We went to the Y and, you know, did some Zumba class, and boy, did we have fun, a lot of exercise. A lot of people should probably also get a lot of exercise. But also, we have a dynamite show on tonight. Eric is on assignment somewhere, and we're going to be talking to Byron, and Byron is going to be coming on, and Wayne, and when they come on, I'm going to ask them to mention their last names. Kay Thompson Live, everyone, and I hope everyone is doing fine. And I have a friend of mine here who is being very, very quiet here. My daughter Lisa is really with me. Would you like to say something, Lisa? No, she's not saying anything. Anyway, excuse me, our guest today, you know, tonight, is going to be William Lauren Katz. Now, you may have been heard Bill Katz's name over and over and over on this show and on the air and everywhere else, I would imagine, because the fact that he is the author of over 40 books, including such award-winning titles as Breaking the Chains, African-American Slave Resistance, The Black West, a documentary and a pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States, and everyone else. So Black Women of the Old West. He has lectured in Europe, Africa, in the United States. He's been a scholar in residence at Teachers College, Columbia University, New York University. He's been on with me for a long period of time. He's a good friend, and boy, what books he has out. We're going to be talking tonight about Black Indians. And I think I see there that one of our partners here is on the air. Is this Byron?
Byron, yes, are you is. There? Good Byron, evening.
Good evening.
I am here in the UK. Yes, thank
I
you.
I know. Well,
it's another great day. Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I noticed that you were sitting there. You know, not sitting there, but I noticed that you were very, very quiet, Byron.
Well, I was listening to you and realizing that tonight's story with Bill Katz and the Black Indians, what a story that is, because we have so much to say about the Trail of Tears and the Osage Indians in Oklahoma and Seminoles in Florida, the Matinecocks who are in New York. I mean, the story is a story that really Americans should know, and it's unfortunate we don't teach that in our history books.
Well, we do. In some schools, we do. When I was teaching in school in Newark, I did, because the fact that I was very interested in, you know, the Indians anyway. And so a lot of the people, really, our people, know a lot about it, except for the fact that they don't know enough. That's it. And Bill Katz is part of the writer. I have a whole list of books here that he has done, you know. He's the author of 40 books. And I don't know if it should be more than that right now, you know, including award-winning titles as Breaking the Chains, African-American Slave Resistance, The Black West, a documentary and a pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States, and Black Women of the Old West. And that's really fascinating also. Now, we're going to have to get Wayne Gilman in, I think, here, or another caller. I don't recognize that number, but, yes, that could be Bill Katz. Are you there? Hello?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Bill Katz, how are you? How are you?
I'm fine, Kay. How are you?
Fine. Coughing a little bit of sniffles. But I was just, you know, telling people about your book. Now, this latest book that I have is an up-to-date version of Black Indians. So tell us about it a little bit.
Yeah, well, this is the new revised and expanded
edition. Bill, wait a minute. I want to tell you that we do have another person on, another partner, who is Byron. Byron there? Are you there?
Yes, I am here. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi,
so
Byron.
Bill Katz, good evening, Bill. Byron Saunders.
It's a pleasure once again to be speaking with you, Bill. So I'm anxious to hear more of your stories.
Okay.
And Wayne Gillen will be calling in very shortly, I'm sure.
Okay. Okay. I got the cast of characters.
Now, this is the latest edition of Black Indians. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, I had to expand it because I had to leave a lot. The first edition was done for young adults, so it had to be restricted to just under 200 pages. But this one is about a third larger, almost 100 pages of more material, even more pictures and photographs and documentary evidence. And
yeah,
I was able to get a lot more in of all kinds of interesting material I had to leave out of the first edition.
Yeah.
If I give you an example, I got in the story of a woman named Isabel de Oliveira, who was of African descent, and she landed in the Americas in 1600, and she wanted to go on a trip to Santa Fe. So she went before.
Now, Bill, listen.
Yes.
Listen, let me just interrupt you for a second. Wayne Gillen is on the phone, our other partner here. Wayne, are you there?
Oh, sure.
Want to bring
yes,
you in?
I am. Good evening, Dr. Katz, Kay.
Good
Eric,
evening, Wayne.
Byron.
How are you?
I'm okay. How's everyone on your end there?
Very good. Very good.
Very good. I hate to interrupt, but go ahead with your story.
Okay.
You want me to finish? Yeah, about Isabel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here she is in the in Hispaniola, now Haiti, Dominican Republic.
Right.
And she's a free woman of color. She's unmarried. She's traveling alone. And she is of mixed ancestry. She is both African and Native American, showing that this mixture was taking place really early. This is before Jamestown or Plymouth or anything like that. And she goes before a magistrate, maybe the mayor of the city there, and she draws up a statement describing herself in just those words. I am of African, a Native American descent. She names her father. She names her mother. She is not married. And she doesn't want any trouble, she announces. And she ends her statement with, I demand justice. And I found this absolute. Here's 1600. You know, ordinary Americans like us, we're not even looking into the history. We're still stuck in our own books about Jamestown and Plymouth, which occur decades after this woman makes this statement and has been in the Americas, part of an African presence that was there for many years. So that's the kind of thing I have in the new edition, along with more material on the Buffalo Soldiers and on Senator B.K. Bruce, who was the a black senator who served in the U.S. Congress for 6 years from representing the state of Mississippi. He was the only black senator from Mississippi to serve a full six-year term. And he got up and he denounced the expulsion. These are his words. Expulsion and extinction policy of the United States against Native Americans. And, you know, he was of pure African descent, but he was moved, as a number of Africans were, both black Indians and those of pure African descent, to stand up for Native American rights, just as I've written recently about how Black Lives Matter showed up in force to defend the Native American nations of more than 100 at Standing Rock, fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kind of things I have in that new edition, yes.
And Dr. Katz, I was just wondering, was he the first African-American to ever be a part of the United States Congress as a senator?
No. No, he was not. A few years before, around, let's see, the voting came through around 1868, 1869. And when blacks could go to vote after the Civil War, and they were defended, they had to be defended by United States troops at the time. And there were others that were elected. I don't have all the names in front of me, but he came along pretty fast afterward. And Mississippi was one of the states, along with South Carolina, which had, by the way, the largest slave populations. They also had the largest free black populations after the Civil War. And so they elected more congressmen and senators than a lot of the other border and other states.
Interesting. Because I know a lot has been said about Edward Brooke from Massachusetts, and of course,
right,
you know, that's more current, but you seldom hear about black history as it pertains to Congress going back that far.
Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a quick summary. There were 22 black men elected to Congress from the end of the Civil War to 1900. One of them, by the way, was a guy from North Carolina, former slave, named George Henry White, who served two full terms. He, by the way, had even a lot of white support from his state, which is interesting, because that's another part of the narrative that's left out, is that a number of the black people running for office had the support of poor whites in the South after the Civil War. There were people like Albert Parsons, a former Confederate soldier who went out and campaigned for black candidates and went around the country. He was in Texas. And he got beat up twice, one time in the House of Representatives of the Texas legislature, because he was beaten up by Klansmen. There were brave black people that did come around to seeing they needed to support black candidates because they needed to have a mixed government that would be concerned about all of the people of the state. I really have to tell you, I take great pride and writing about people like this, because it's a history that's not known. It should
exactly.
be taught in our schools.
And
we could
all sit here and ask that question: why it's not being taught, though? But that's another story.
Long story.
But you know, with you, Bill Katz, you know, you have come out with a whole lot of books that that I'm just partially, finished. And it's really a lot of information. I've had you on the air for many, many times. And, you learn something new every single day. Have you ever heard the name Black Bill Plummer Joyner? Have you ever heard that name?
Say the name again, please.
He goes by the name, or he went by the name of Black Bill Plummer Joyner.
I don't recognize the name.
Yeah, okay.
Me
neither. We wanted to check.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so what was happening during the time of the Buffalo Soldiers? Let's get into that, because they were a very famous troop of soldiers, of black soldiers.
Yeah, this was the 9th and 10th Cavalry, called by the Army U.S. Colored Troops, end quote. And black men had won the right from their glory during the Civil War to serve in the United States Army. And therefore, they were recruited then after the Civil War, the 9th and 10th Cavalry units, black people, these black men, were not allowed to become officers, but they could join the Army, and they were sent out as part of the United States policy of rounding up Native Americans, putting them on reservations and keeping the peace out west. And I've written about them in a number of my books, including the fact that, a matter of fact, in the new edition of Black Indians, I talk about, I'm trying to find his name here, but yeah, George Washington Williams was a sergeant major in the 9th Cavalry. He was a former slave. He escaped, and he served except when he heard that his white officers who were over him, commissioned officers, talking about what they wanted to do to the Indians. And he decided he was a good Christian. He could not remain in an army that was going to kill and maim Native Americans simply for racial reasons. So he left it there after faithful service. Now, we don't know how many other African Americans in the Buffalo Soldiers and the infantry units, the 24th and 25th infantry units out west, felt that way. But we know about him. Thank goodness he left a record of it. And it does tell us that there was resistance among the black soldiers to fighting Indians, to brutalizing them as the Washington policy demanded. And that's another one of the stories in the revised edition of Black Indians. By the way, I bring that up because if any of your listeners are going to order the book online, they have to be careful that they get the 2014 revised edition. That's the one that has the, you know, a much more complete picture.
Is that
by
the one
way,
that
I think.
Is that
me?
The one that I have? Is that
yes.
The one that I have? Your latest one? Oh, okay. So give out that
yes.
information again.
On
give
the
out
edition.
That information again.
Yeah, it's the 2014 edition. It's in both hardcover and paperback.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it says on the cover, it says a revised edition and something, I think it says new chapters on it, right on the cover.
Right.
But
the
by the way,
yeah.
Okay, you wanted me to tell something about this program that's coming up that I've been invited to participate in
yes.
Brooklyn?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I can give the information on that. For those people that are interested, Muriel Tillinghast, who is a director of the Brooklyn Society of Ethical Culture, has asked me to participate a second time. She had me out there a year or so ago, to the Brooklyn Society for Ethical Culture on Wednesday, May 24th at 6 p.m. I'm just saying that because I know I have a lot of friends in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, for that matter, in parts of New Jersey, they might be willing to come down. The address is 53 Prospect Park West, and at 6:30 on May 24th. The theme of the presentation is interesting. Muriel found out that this is the 50th anniversary of my first book, Eyewitness, coming out, which became, I think you know, Kay, a leading text in the field of African-American history and based on my 14 years as a public school teacher integrating the material into my American history courses. But the theme of this particular presentation is I've been asked to talk about using references to my different books, the various forms of resistance mounted by people of color and others from the beginning of the Americas, from the beginning of the European landings, I should say, and going up through all kinds of movements that took place and so on. So I've kind of been putting together the things that I want to cover, starting with the 1526 colony that was formed by the Spaniards in a part of North Carolina, as I said, in 1526, in which they brought over 100 slaves. But the Spaniards didn't know what to do. They took ill. They were too ill to even fish, although there were many fish where they had settled. They couldn't plant. They had disputes over who was going to lead them. And finally, they picked up and left, just as the Native Americans and the Africans they had brought over, the 100 Africans, teamed up and helped everybody escape to Native American villages. So it was called San Miguel de Gualdape. And when the Europeans left for home, they just packed up, couldn't handle it, and left. The Africans and Native Americans founded what I believe is the first successful foreign colony on U.S. soil. It wasn't Jamestown.
Wow.
It wasn't Plymouth. It was this group of Africans joining with Native Americans. And, of course, what it meant was here was a colony not based on slavery, not based on exploiting one race over another or reducing one race to an inferior position, but camaraderie. And, of course, these two people intermingled. They married. They raised families. We don't have hardly any record at all of them because they didn't leave anything, and their colony was probably overrun in about 50 years or maybe a little more. But they were the first foreign colony, and it shows that resistance pays off. And then I'm going to go into, for example, people don't know that on the slave ships that brought millions of Africans here, there were roughly 100 conspiracies and rebellions. Now, everybody knows about the Amistad because there was a famous movie made about the Amistad Rebellion. But there were about 99 others that nobody heard about. And just as, you know, when the slaves were brought here, they didn't just put up with it, despite what our textbooks told children for years and years. There are 150 revolts and conspiracies on the plantations of the South. It wasn't just the one that Turner led that has been made into a movie twice now, and but a lot of others that went on and shook the Confederacy. Well, before there was a Confederacy, it shook the slaveocracy that was running the Southern states. And for that matter, if I get into the Civil War, you actually have a Civil War that was fought and won by the presence of 178,958 black men serving in the Union Army, 10% of the total. They fought in 449 engagements, 39 major battles, and earned 22 Medals of Honor, the first time the Medals of Honor were awarded. I mean, this is a fantastic contribution, and it was so great that President Lincoln said, if I had to not use or give up my black troops, we'd have to quit the war in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Because they took part in a number of battles. They liberated Charleston, South Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, and a whole series of major cities. And so what the Civil War was using the manpower that was once enslaved for the Confederacy on the side of the Union. And, of course, it's so important to remember, these black soldiers came in at a very moment when nobody, neither the Union nor the Confederacy, had any more reserves to call on. So that's why they helped tip the balance. Here they were, fresh troops, and boy, they were eager to go. And by the way, some 25,511 black men served in the Union Navy, where they were one-fourth of the total in the Navy. And they integrated the Navy. They didn't bother to have a separate Navy as I served in when I served in World War II. So that was quite an advance, because freedom was on on the agenda finally.
Bill, I'm gonna interrupt you for a minute because Eric is here. My son Eric Payne is here, and I want him to get in on this discussion. He also has a graduate of Hampton University, and I happen to know of Hampton with their Indian students that they had. And I remember a story that was told to me. As a matter of fact, it was this book that I had, and they said that, yes, they had Indian students there at the university, and the only problem that the they had with the Indian students was that they they didn't want to take off their blankets. And there were Indian students that attended Hampton University. Now, this is brand new information, and this book is absolutely, you know, wonderful. So, Eric, you want to get in here on the air?
Indian students were there in the 1800s when I was first there, so I wasn't at the school.
You know that.
I know that that's part of the history, but that's about as far as I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, but and Booker T. Washington was the one put in charge of them. When
right,
they
he
were
founded
there
the school
in the early years. Yep.
So we're going to. Anybody else?
You want me to go on?
Bill, I'm really just fascinated with this book. I didn't even know the questions to answer because all of a sudden I see. A whole lot of black soldiers, you know, early on, way before, a lot of years before I was born, I see American Indians, not only from the United States, but Europeans, and they haven't been thoroughly studied. I think that's what you say here. And how did you happen to get all this information? Where did you get it from? Who was writing these books?
Well, let me just say this. It's not a miracle. It's nice to take credit, but there were this story, this mixture, both of these people and their contributions have been lying around for hundreds and hundreds of years. I did not invent this stuff. I found it, and black historians have been writing about it. You know, John Hope Franklin, who was so complimentary. Book Black Indians, he himself was born of a black Indian family out in Oklahoma, and his father was a famous lawyer, and he was delighted when my Black Indians book came out because I had put so much of it together, but he knew about it and a lot of others knew about it and had been writing about it before I came along. And the sad thing is the material was there for other white historians to write about it, and they didn't bother. Or they distorted it, and they certainly left it out.
That part, if you don't mind interrupting here, it just amazes me what goes on, because based on what you said a little earlier, it's very apparent that the Spanish Empire was also deeply involved with the slave trade with respect to Africans. You don't hear much about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there were probably more slaves carried to South. There were definitely more slaves carried to South American countries, Brazil, Argentina, and so on, than there were brought to the United States.
And that's as a result of the Spanish Empire. We're not even talking about what happened here. With respect to the period in which most people refer to the slave trade period, it escapes me what we call it, going back to the Amistad and all that, this is prior to that.
Oh, yes. It was
we're talking about 1400s.
That's correct. And the Pope at the time, in 1493, drew a line down through the Atlantic, giving Spain control of the slave trade by drawing that line down. He not only divided the world up in pieces, to be settled by Catholics and take over any land that was there, even if there were millions of people on it, but it also divided the slave trade, giving the vast majority of it to the Spaniards.
Well, you know, Dr. Katz, wow. The one thing that I find interesting with respect to that, it seems that a lot of nations outside, as the planet, you know, grew as more civilized, that they did away with the slavery issue and the issues of racial dichotomies a lot sooner than what happened here in the States. Am I right in thinking that? I'm not saying that racism still doesn't exist out there in places like South America, in the parts of the Caribbean and Central America, but it just seems that governments were far more outgoing in not conducting that level of ignorant activity compared to what is so deeply ingrained in the United States culture.
You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. Well, a lot of it had to do with the Catholic Church, which took the stand that each individual has a soul, and therefore they could not completely degrade the person that they enslaved. Mm. And they wanted to induct the Africans into the Catholic religion, and they did that, and it resulted, the treatment was often not as bad and not as long-lasting as what happened in the United States, where the racism was really sharpened in such a way, and a whole propaganda that we call racism was developed to justify it, and it led to all kinds of atrocious behavior on the parts of slave masters and overseers toward those who were enslaved, including and especially slaved women.
Mm.
Okay.
That's fascinating, because right. I've heard stories within Catholicism about their involvement. I've heard of the story about the Black Madonna and all that, but I never thought that actually they've shaped an opinion that led to a lot of this dissolving in terms of it being a worldwide crisis, even though it still exists. I think there'll always be some level of prejudice, because people are different.
Yes.
But,
well, no, it's not because people are different. There's a new book out on racism. It's a very heavy book. It's called Stamped from the Beginning. It's about 400 or 500 pages. You don't want to drop it on your foot. But boy, what I conclude, I'm reading it in order to review it, and I also want to interview the author at some point. Let me just get you his name. Ibram X. Kendi. He's a professor at a Northern Florida college, and he's persuading me that what came first was racism and then race. It was racism that developed the concept that there are races, because it was a system of justifying the enslavement and brutal treatment of one group of people who were white by another, all other groups who were not. And
okay.
Out of this developed this theory of racism.
No, I agree, and I happen to understand that, but it just seems to be more institutionalized with respect to the American history, and that even going back to the Republic of South Africa, what was going on there. It was followed the blueprint of what was happening here in the States.
Wayne, I hate to interrupt with this, and Bill Katz, I hate to interrupt this, but, we have to go to another subject right now.
Sure.
And I want you to come back next week. And I want people to, it's really fascinating. I'm reading this book, and I am so fascinated with it. I have so many questions. Now, everybody, you need to get Eyewitness News by Bill Katz also. That is the most complete history on anything black going on in the country. Bill Katz, I'm going to end it right now. How can people get to buy a book or to get some information?
Well, they can. I don't know about buying a book. That they can do on the internet. But they can go to my website, williamlkatz.com, and you can read an awful lot of three articles there on the subjects we're talking about tonight and others that I didn't get around to. You can even see some of the pictures there. And I think there's a way of ordering books through my website. I'm not sure if it's still up.
Yeah.
But thank you for having me on, and thank all of you.
Have a good night.
And thank you. Great stuff.
Okay, you too.
You know, I'm rushing now, but
okay.
You know, you're going to be back in a couple of weeks anyway. You know, thanks a lot.
Fine.
Okay.
Great. Night, Kate.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Sorry, we had to end that, you know, really early, but, you know, we had another thing scheduled, and we will be having Mr. Katz back on, you know, in just about another maybe 2 or 3 weeks, because he is a fantastic writer, and he is a writer who writes about Black history, African American history. He writes about so many different, it's a lot to remember. If you want to read a history book about the history of the United States and Blacks in America, go to his book, Eyewitness News. And I think it's now in the school systems, or it's been in the school systems, maybe in the colleges, because it's very complete historical, you know, presentation. Okay, Eric Payne is here, my son, and we're going to be talking about the celebration the other night, Donald Payne's, celebration, the gala. It was absolutely fantastic. Donald Payne, who was the congressman, you know, his father was Donald Payne Sr., and we went to the gala the other night, and it was at the, downtown Newark is absolutely fantastic. So we had the fifth annual congressional ball honoring Donald M. Payne Jr., and his special guest, what I was very impressed with, and I'm not surprised because he's been there before, but Congressman John Lewis himself, the 5th District in Georgia, you know, and it was just a really wonderful occasion. It was cocktail reception, and it was at the Robert Treat Hotel, downtown Newark, and Newark is brand new, everyone. You really want to see it.
Yeah, it was a really good event. It was the first time that we did this fundraiser back at the Robert Treat Hotel, the refurbished, renewed Robert Treat. We were at the Nora Club for a number of years on the top floor, which had a spectacular view of the city and New York. Unfortunately, they went out of business, and Robert Treat is where they had some original fundraisers back in the day, Ma, for Uncle Donald when he first ran for public office. Yeah. So it was a pleasure, and it was nostalgic being back there, but it was new again. And we had the icon, civil rights legend John Lewis there. And, you know, it's rare that you get to meet someone who's put it all on the line, who really walked it like he talked it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry that I didn't hop up and say something that day. But John Lewis is someone, you know, the young people say he keeps it 100, you know. I know you know about that, Byron. I don't know about Wayne. Wayne's a little old school, but he keeps it 100, right? I mean, whenever you meet someone who walked it like they talk it and put their life on the line for what they believe in, then reverence needs to be paid to that man whenever you see them. And I am in awe and humbled every time I am in his presence. He is a regular man, but he has given us so much, and he's put his life on the line for us as a people and America as a country. And it was really an honor to have him there and address the audience, address us here.
And you know one thing, I did go up and we did talk for a minute there, more than a couple minutes. And he consented to come to be on the show.
Right.
So, John Lewis, thank you, and we'll be talking soon. And he is going to be coming. Yeah. He assured me that it was.
We also had Mayor Raz Baraka was there.
Yeah.
Congressman Frank Pallone came out. Congressman and a great many other of the statewide and countywide people that are supportive of Congressman Payne, as well as active and moving the political agenda forward for all the constituents in the 10th District and Essex County in general. It was a great time. Wish you guys could have been there, Brother Saunders and Brother Gilman. You missed out on a good time.
I was missing in action. I it's hard to keep up with all the events involving the pain. You know, I guess I need to have a calendar started like early in the year. But I'm glad that, it was well attended and all that. And it's interesting, if I may just take a moment to say something to show and I'm not embarrassed by this at all. I'm a little naive when it comes to the internet. A funny thing happened to me Sunday. I've been working, doing what I normally do now with respect to, you know, my real estate profession. And a friend of mine just took a break and said, would you like to drive out to the island to a particular restaurant way out on the East End up in the Hamptons, a place that I like to used to go to when I was a child in the summer up in Sag Harbor? Quick story. And my friend has a modern car. I'd still drive. I'm the Warren Buffett in my community. I still drive a 20-year-old car, and I'm proud of it, you know. And I was so fascinated by the fact that this person had internet radio. And the person knew that I do a weekly show with you guys, you know. And she was able to bring Kay Thompson Live up. It was actually the previous show that we did. And I was mesmerized because on this Cadillac screen, it showed my name, your name, Kay the host, Byron, had a caption of the subject matter. And I listened for the whole show from New Rochelle to Sag Harbor, about an hour. And it was like, it took me back to listening to your mother, Eric, on WLIB. Mm-hmm. It was clear the signal. Mm-hmm. There was no interruption, no interference. And I feel like I've been in the dark ages, but I just had to tell this, share this story with you tonight because it was so fascinating that I begged her to listen to another show on the way back.
Which one was that?
You know, forgive my ignorance, but we've arrived, and Kay, you sound so young. You sound, all of you sound so vibrant, and I need to do something about my whole phone.
We all do. And I got a 20-plus-year-old car, too, bro. And the only time I get to hear the internet radio is when I ride in somebody else's car, Lisa or my sister Christy. You know, so I'm right there with you. I got crank windows, okay? So, you know.
Yeah, I remember that. Actually, that predates me, okay?
So we got about 17 minutes. I just want to get some brief thoughts about, you know, I don't know if you guys touched on the current events of our president and his buddy, the Mike Flynn, wanting to – I think Mike Flynn is going to get locked up. The guy who led the locker up chant is looking at potentially getting locked up.
Good.
Ain't that something? Talk about karma. You know what they say about.
Yeah, considering his involvement, and when you look at his portfolio, even I asked the question: how come he didn't register as a foreign agent representative? I mean, he's a mercenary.
Wow.
He is a what you would call a soldier of fortune who, once he retired, engaged in representing foreign governments, trying to persuade deals on the, as a lobbyist. And that's not an accident. Everything he did was intentional. Now, pushing the blame as to why he didn't get vetted properly, it has to go to the administration, who ultimately had him and as a agent for them during the campaign. So it's not like these were just anomalies that were just revealed. This was ongoing, and much of the administration, in terms of the who is running what agency, very much the same concept. You know, Trump's vision of running the federal government is the same vision that he has had for his businesses, which is why they are bankrupt. He's trying to bankrupt like a pirate. He is thinking he can literally, you know, minimize federal government's effectiveness and then, like a pirate, take over. That's a coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. We need to stop him. We really need to stop him now because he is out of control.
We need to stop Trump.
Yeah, I agree 100% with you. Also today, too, with the new tax plan that they put forth, you know, there was a reporter who put it in the briefing. A reporter said, you know, he's cutting all these taxes. He's kind of cutting his own taxes, right?
Yeah.
This tax proposal, he's saying, will save him. Some, they said, like $36 million or something. And of course, Angry Spice just blew it off. But it's, I mean, we're in uncharted territory in terms of our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
This seems like the type of territory that the United States was in after Reconstruction or after the Civil War or after, you know, the Depression or World War II. The craziness of it. This man committed treason, stole the presidency. Somehow they made his lies worse than Hillary's lies. You know, I mean, the whole thing about Hillary, right, was like she lied about the emails and the train of thought they were trying to establish. If I'm mistaken, if I have it correct, and you guys chime in here, was that the emails led to she had emails from Christopher Smith, the guy, the ambassador who got killed. So they were trying to establish like she was directly responsible because she didn't respond to the emails about having security early enough. So Benghazi happened as a result of Hillary's lack of. I think that's the kind of argument that they were trying to make. So that's why they're trying to always subpoena the emails, because they're trying to draw a correlation that her lies caused the death of Americans, right? I mean, am I correct in establishing that as their line of attack? Did you guys read that?
That's their premise, Eric. But, I mean, in all honesty, I mean, the thing is, that was basically a distraction deliberately done because there is a contingency out there, no matter how popular the Democrats were and all the divisiveness that went on between Sanders and Clinton and both camps and all that. All that stuff is coming out now to a certain extent, but Trump knew how to play that card just to work in his benefit. But, I mean, you know, as Farrakhan would tell you, a house built on sand will not stand. Trust me, Trump's house is coming down soon. Flynn was the first appointee, if I'm not mistaken. All this stuff is coming out in the open now.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that really, I read this the other day, and this is as much as mind-blowing as anything, the mother of all bombs that was dropped in Afghanistan. Now, I don't know if you saw this, but if you traced the connection and the site that they bombed, literally was a site that the CIA built when the Russians were fighting against Afghanistan. And we paid, and the CIA built it for the Mujahideen, and here's the piece that will blow your mind. You know who they built it for on his behalf? Osama bin Laden.
Wow.
Right. So when they blew it up, they weren't blowing up anything that was strategic. It was something the CIA built. And they built it with the intention of trying to divert the drug traffic trade that the Russians, reasons why Russia was involved in Afghanistan was because they wanted to take over the drug traffic trade market.
Wow.
A very lucrative market. Now,
opium trade. You're talking about that opium trade.
That's
right.
Exactly. The opium trade. Now, here's another piece of information that's equally as mind-blowing. All this blustering about North Korea and the nuclear weapons is not even about the nuclear weapons, folks. Do you know what the chief agricultural product of North Korea is? Opium.
What?
Oh, okay. Opium. So the pop, that's right. They have a poppy.
That's right.
Poppy seed
and
culture
that
there, too.
Is the, right. Now, remember, we were in Vietnam for the same very reason. It wasn't about democracy or a threat to our national security. It was all about who was in control of the Southeast Asian drug market. And when we were in San Salvador, it wasn't about national security. Once again, cocaine and crack. It was about the drug market control of the billion-dollar industry. In Afghanistan, there are two major crops. In Afghanistan, one is a crop, and that's poppies, because now they are the chief, the chief agents for distributing opioids by way of their poppy fields. That's why it's in small town America. And the other thing that's in Afghanistan more than anything else is uranium. Now you put all these these dots, and you realize that we have been bamboozled, and no wonder we're all messed up in this country because the truth is not being revealed. And it's not that difficult to find it. It really isn't.
And it's never been.
For which, that's right. That's right.
It's never
so
been
have,
that way.
We really have a enormous problem that America is being duped, and all these so-called executive orders that are being passed, the tax code issue. I mean, you look at the tax code issue, and already the senators on the Hill are balking at it. They're balking at this new health care agenda that's going to be coming back up again. It is absolutely dead on arrival. Even the Republicans are saying that. So this is a – unfortunately,
but also,
we have – yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, finish your point.
I was just going to say that I think what's really important next step, what is to be done, because the drip, drip, drip of information that is being revealed about the collaboration and the collusion of everything that goes. I mean, even with – I've read that Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan got $10 million each out of the Russian money. I mean, this is engaged in so many areas that it's not just Trump and his administration, but really what's going to be interesting is the fortitude of the United States Senate and Congress, who should take over and restore the integrity of this country's democracy back in order, because right now it is out of order.
No question about it. And I think the only thing, just to piggyback on what you're saying there, Byron, is that we have to remain resolute. Every time an issue comes forward, we have to be out there. There's got to be an act of aggression. You know, things have got to be talked about. There's got to be more protest. I was pleased to see the science community come out the other day. You know, I mean, there's so many different things that are going on now because he's in control, you know. And I'm not saying that he's not vulnerable. He knows he's vulnerable, but he's certainly going to try to turn the clock back, you know, and he has succeeded to a certain extent. But, you know, it's like to have to go through this nonsense. You know, I worry about programs that will affect large cities like New York, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just unfortunate what we're facing, you know. The Medicaid is, you know, with respect to the Affordable Health Care Act, you know, he wants to make significant changes. The tax changes he's proposed only benefits billionaires. Doesn't help anyone else but those, you know, that element. And it's so egregious what he gets away with now, but I believe, you know, it's not going to be forever. I think he is not going to see the end of his four terms. I'm not espousing his death or anything by that, but I feel something's going to come up that's going to be so monumental that he'll be out of there. And we got to focus on the local races to make sure people like Donald Payne Jr. and others of his, the party support, but we have to do this across the country, you know. I mean, it's got to be, you know, an ongoing thing just to have people on a local level affixed to a certain standard of politics, and that's it.
Right. We've got to take back the state houses, as you know, all across the country, and that's where this legislation comes up and further affects the national elections, as you know, with these state houses, these various states cutting back on or restricting voting rights. They're calling the voter ID laws, but we know that their mission is to restrict the voting rights of African-American and Hispanic people. Of Texas, you know, the ruling was that that law was almost designed with surgical precision, a judge ruled, to restrict the right to vote of black and brown people. So we need to be active and take back a lot of these state houses, which then sets the agenda and the support for the federal level. And you know, like you said, he's in control now. But the thing that bothers me or that I want everybody to concentrate on and keep their eye on is that he is trying to get as much done before he gets out or gets busted,
mm-hmm.
they all are,
yeah.
As they possibly can before, you know, because everybody's, you know, every time I hear people, the news, even the media, the talking heads, referring to this man and what he does as president as if it's normal,
mm-hmm.
as if, you know,
yes.
almost like they're hoping enough time goes by and enough people forget about the fact that this man not only stole the election, committed treason, refused to release his taxes, and it's tax time now, and is now cutting his own taxes. I mean, all these
right.
things that are clear and obvious, all because of the racism in America that
mm-hmm.
these people wanted to see this man in office. Remember, they went past all of the other guys who weren't as extreme as Donald Trump. They went to Donald Trump, the most extreme guy, who really was talking about everybody, was saying they're all bad and adopted that whole mentality of those very limited people that are limited intellectually, people that are gullible and they vote their emotion, they voted their hatred. And so, you know, he was able to capitalize on that. The thing that I find unbelievable is when you hear this man lying over and over again in the course of a 10-minute speech,
mm-hmm.
and then get called out on it at a press conference when you say, I've had the most electoral votes than ever. And a reporter gets up and says, well, actually, no, you didn't. Well, I was talking about Republicans. Well, actually, you didn't get that either. Well, I was,
good.
I don't know. And nobody calls this guy on it. You just lied, Mr. President.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's not true. Like, yeah, like today I was watching the show, the 10 a.m., the 9 a.m. hour with this on MSNBC with the host Stephanie Ruhle, and they were talking about Flynn, and there was a guy who used to work for Trump, and then there was another lady there who didn't used to work for Trump. And, you know, they just make up stuff. This guy was like, well, all the evidence is not out yet, and we don't know what happened. They're like, really? They're just looking like, really? And she's the one who said, no, I disagree. That's not quite how it was. And I saw her actually dispute the congressman from Oklahoma, I forget his name, he might even be the senator, where he threw out some numbers, and she said, no, those numbers are incorrect. And he said, no, they are, and no, they're not incorrect. And then, as an aside, he said, at least the numbers I got, right?
Yeah,
so they continue to lie, and they get over on the fact that these things seem circumstantial, and there's not any hard
right.
proof, no smoking gun. And that is also a presupposition that the people you're talking to are stupid. You know, they are stupid. And I don't understand why his voters, you know, they sit there, all these idiots that sat there, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up, led in a cheer by the dude who's getting ready to be locked up, who pretty much committed treason going to business for Turkey, and then Russia. But Turkey, they said the Turkish money was really going back to Putin, right? So these people are unbelievable, and there's a blindness in the fact that, you know, they're willing to go, they're willing to accept the fact that this man cheated, they're willing to accept the fact that he says the most racist, vile things, they're willing to accept the fact that he abused women, just as long as he gets in. I mean, I don't really understand that mentality, except to say that there's obviously a portion of America that is just wrong. Wrong in their hatred, wrong in their belief that black and brown people are second-class citizens, wrong in their belief that they are supreme, you know, so... I don't know. I mean, we got 90 seconds, guys. We've just been running out, but I know we could talk about this like we do every week.
We need to hear more of it.
And
you're preaching to the choir there, Eric. The deal is that something has
we
to
have
be done.
One minute,
you know, you have to
but
keep
got,
talking
got,
about it. You know, we have
exactly.
to hammer it each week. That's the
exactly.
only way to get it across. Because you know
exactly.
the level of decadence that goes on here.
We
got
to go.
Incredible.
We got to go. It's a minute
okay.
left. I want to say thank you to our guest resident, our historian, Mr.
Well,
Byron
thank
Saunders.
Yeah. Thank you,
well,
sir.
It's always
it's
a
privilege
sir.
And a pleasure.
Thank
yes, sir.
Next week, we look forward to it again. Next week, thank you, sir. And also, too, legendary
Wayne.
Newsman, Mr. Wayne Gilman, as always. I want to say
well, thank you.
I hope
appreciate
I didn't.
It. And the show
thank
has
again.
Newfound meaning for me now that I know about internet radio in the car.
I'm going to have to get a new car.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks to you, Eric.
Thanks, Wayne. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Once again, I am the Sun, also known as Eric Payne. Some of you know me as Citizen Payne on Facebook, and you are the one
I am
only.
Kay Thompson Payne, and you've been listening to... K Thompson Live. Join us again every Wednesday, 8 o'clock. Boy, hot show tonight.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Good night.